Everyone will admit that there is an immense body of direct or indirect teaching in these biographies, bearing in the way of illustration at least, if not of proof, upon the commonly received doctrines in the schools of theology. A man need not have gone deeper than Bellarmine in his reading to perceive this. A whole corpus of doctrine and practice might be drawn up out of them, and as a matter of fact, great use is made of them as soon as every man come to teach doctrine or aesthetics in a practical way. Almost all the great works of catechetical instruction are adorned by examples drawn from the lives of the saints, and the same remark will apply to a considerable proportion of our most classical books of devotion. Some of this teaching consists in beautiful enforcements and exemplifications of truths already taught us by authority. Some adds its weight to questions left open to dispute in the Catholic schools, and inclines the balance in this or that direction. Some forms the actual foundation of pious opinions among the faithful, or aids in propagating new devotion, as Saint Teresa gave at least quite a fresh stimulus to the devotion to Saint Joseph, and Venerable Margaret Mary Alico and Father Colombere to that of the Sacred Heart. Even the miracles themselves are in many instances closely connected with doctrine. The truth of all this may at once be shown by a few examples. Saint Philip Neri, previous to the reformed discipline of the Council of Trent, miraculously discovers a youth to be in priest's orders by the shining of his sacerdotal character on his forehead. Saint Catherine of Bologna assures us, and her words are quoted in almost countless treatises of devotion, that she gained whatever she wished through the intercession of the holy souls in purgatory. Yet this appears opposed to the teaching of Saint Thomas. The question of the safety and propriety of the peculiar devotions to the sacred humanity of Jesus, which are found such stumbling blocks by those who are not Catholics and have been so successfully propagated by the sons of Saint Ignatius, is considered as set at rest in no slight degree by the authority of Saint Teresa and the supernatural lights she received on the subject. From the life of Saint Francis Jerome, we gain a fearful knowledge of the intensity of the pains of purgatory. From that of Saint Stanislaus Kostka, we are piously led to believe that the great feasts of the Church Militant are in some way noted in the Church Triumphant. And from that of Blessed Henry Suso, we obtain a most vivid idea of the refreshment of the adorable sacrifice of the Mass to the souls in purgatory. So, from the other lives, we learn the peculiar power which certain prayers appear to have in heaven. For example, the well-known instance of the antiphon sub tuum presidium configimus before the Litany of Loreto, and the words Ea ergo advocata nostra in the Salve Regina, as was revealed to Saint Gertrude. And from the life of the Venerable Benedict Joseph, we learn that a life of perpetual pilgrimage to holy shrines may even in these selfwise days be, with proper vocation, acceptable to Almighty God. Instances may be multiplied almost ad infinitum, but these will suffice. Now it is plain that all this cannot be disposed of in any brief or contemptuous way. The attention, the conscientious, deliberative attention of a Catholic must be arrested by it, and perhaps the more he lives in the practice of the presence of God, the more time he spends in the peaceful regions of prayer, the less will he be inclined to handle these things in a summary and disrespectful way. Can he safely reject as false, or at least not worth of a thought, everything which is not positively de fide? Certainly not. It would be the most unreasoning indiscretion, the most impatient intellectual rashness that could be conceived. It would be the case of a man whose prime care was not to be in harmony with the Church, but just to turn the corner of formal heresy by an adroit and perilous nicety. It would be the case of a man who, through culpable idleness and still more culpable fretfulness of intellect, declined the toil of thought and humble submission to the authority of great and good men which the matter required and exacted, and having thus come to a decision by a faulty moral process, he would be found, as is usual, bigoted in his own opinion, and a loud and irritable censor of those whose opposite conduct appeared to contradict his own. What then would be the course which a wise and pious discretion would pursue? First of all, a man would lay down the authoritative teaching of the Church as his sole rule, his only really divine one, and while he would not venture to assert that everything besides that was false, he would most unhesitatingly assert that everything which contradicted that was beyond all controversy false, and secondly, that whatever even seemed the least out of harmony with the rule was of no account to be received until the apparent discrepancy was reconciled in some way or other, and thirdly, that in no subject matter would he evince more slowness, more jealousy, more suspicion than in the case of these apparent discrepancies with authorized teaching, and fourthly, that the more exclusively such matters rested on visions, revelations, prophecies, and the like, all the more cautious would he be in receiving them, because he would feel himself within the special province of spiritual delusions.